Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. Peter Suderman is off today due to illness. He's under the weather. But I am joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post. Alyssa, how are you doing today?
I am super excited, and congratulations to my colleagues who won Pulitzers today. So it's exciting. Huzzah!
Huzzah. All right, first up in controversies and non-troversies, tariffs come for the movie business. Late on Sunday, Donald Trump announced via Truth Social that he will be placing a 100% tariff on foreign-made movies because America has been losing film production to overseas nations that offer tax credits for Hollywood to shoot there. This makes it a national security threat, naturally, in part because foreign markets are leading to American films creating propaganda for foreign regimes. This is one of those things where Donald Trump identifies a problem, right? American film production is increasingly globalized, and this has led to a reduction in American soft power, and then goes about trying to solve it in the stupidest way possible. So stupid that no one actually seems to have any idea what a, quote, 100% tariff on foreign-made films would look like. Not even his own commerce secretary, who's like, I think responded on Twitter, on it, boss. Like, that's what I send to my bosses when they're like, hey, why don't you interview Tom Cruise for his new movie? Get Tom Cruise on the show. I'm on it, boss. Anyway, we'll get to all that in a second. I just want to like steel man Trump's argument first, right? As best as I can parse it anyway. Once upon a time, most movies made in America were shot in Los Angeles, in Hollywood, California, right? Then movies began being shot all around the country, at first because they wanted to get, you know, more realism, right? They wanted to shoot on location. They wanted on-location visuals. Then because cities and states started offering tax credits. If you ever wondered why a disproportionate number of mid-budget action movies in the 1990s and 2000s were shot in New Orleans for some reason, it's because Louisiana was offering extremely good tax incentives to shoot there. Michigan has done the same. Other states have
Georgia,
offered.
Georgia in particular.
Right. As I was about to say, more recently, Atlanta became a hub for the big budget Disney and Marvel movies because Georgia offered the best incentives. If you've ever watched a Disney or Marvel movie, there's often a big Georgia peach at the end of the credits saying thank you to Georgia for all the money you gave us. Well, the rest of the world has gotten into the game. And if you're shooting in a warehouse anyway, you might as well shoot in London if you're going to be shooting anywhere, right? And so Disney recently moved a lot of its production, including the upcoming $350 million or so budgeted Avengers movie, to London, meaning more jobs in London for Londoners and fewer jobs in America for Americans. The tariff is intended to bring those productions back to the United States, presumably. All right. So that's I think, the argument, basically. The problem is that in reality, Hollywood has a trade surplus with literally every nation on the planet that matters, right? We are a net exporter of entertainment to the tune of $15.3 billion from movie studios. American studios dominate the global market, is what I'm saying. And tariffs are supposed to kind of equalize that trade balance. A tariff is not the right tool to fix this, you know, quote unquote problem, right? And that's before we even get into your stickier question of like, how do you even levy a tariff on something like a movie? Because a movie isn't really what's being tariffed. It's the distribution. He's trying to put a tariff on a service. That gets into a very tricky thing, right? But like, let's look at this. What are you going to send a bill for 100% of the budget to a studio? Do you add 100% surcharge to every movie ticket? Do you block the importation of movie files so they can't be shown in America on DCPs, the digital cinema packages? There is no import here, is my point. There's no physical thing coming into ports to put a tariff on.
But also, it's not like Americans are like spending vast quantities of money on like French cinema or like, you know, Bollywood, or there's just
right. No, I mean, there's no universe in which this makes sense, right? Let's use a concrete example. Right. Let's use just a concrete example. Netflix bought distribution rights for Emilia Perez, right?
Yes.
A movie that was made by a French company. It was shot in France and Mexico. Netflix paid something like $12 million for it. That was the reported number. Under the Trump tariff regime, does that mean Netflix would pay $12 million to the federal government for the right to air it in the United States? Would they have to pay $12 million plus the production budget of the movie? Would they just pay for the production budget of the movie that was in France and Mexico? What is the formula here? Do you create some sort of formula to tax the monthly subscription fee? Netflix has 57% of its stuff is foreign, so we're going to add, you know, $14 to everybody's $20 Netflix. Nobody knows. Nobody knows how any of this will work. Nobody in the studios has any ideas how this works. I was texting with some friends in the industry. They're like, I don't know, man. I don't know. None of this makes any sense. Probably not going to happen anyway, right?
I think Netflix should be fined $28 million for foisting Emilio Perez on all of us.
That's fair.
And then isn't this why you appoint like John Voight and Sylvester Stallone and who's the third of his conservative Hollywood stars?
Mel Gibson.
Isn't this like a meta movie where you turn the three of them into like debt collectors and they go around like breaking people's kneecaps in Hollywood and like they bring American production home? I don't know. I mean, that's the closest thing I can come up with to a rational enforcement mechanism. Like these three like kind of old guys show up at your door and are like, we want that money. It's due today. And then, you know, studios just sort of like throw a bunch of dollar bills at them and attempt to disappear behind the dollar bills really quickly.
Well, this is apparently someone reported, I think Trump himself said today that he settled on this idea after having dinner with John Voight this weekend. So John Voight was like, boss, they're stealing all our movie production. We're losing all the movie production. And like, I think there's an argument to be made that the United States has to do a better job of making it cheaper to shoot in the United States. It's very expensive to shoot in many places in the United States, particularly Los Angeles, where the permitting process is out of control. Unions are very expensive. It's expensive to shoot in New York City, right? You know, again, permits are very expensive. You got a lot of unions you got to deal with. It's expensive to shoot in the United States, and it is cheaper to shoot in places where they are not just going to make it easier for you to shoot, but they're also just going to give you a bunch of money, right? The tax credit thing is tricky and it's hard.
Yeah, well, and it's distorting too, right? I mean, it's sort of mathematical chicanery on the budgets to a certain extent. It's kind of the movie-specific version of the low interest rates that subsidized a lot of sort of tech-friendly lifestyle startups. And it's kind of a race to the bottom, right? I mean, I am not a fan of sort of entertainment subsidies in general, right? I mean, I think that given that they are sort of constantly sold as a way to generate jobs, there's a ton of economic research that suggests no locality ever sort of gets the bang for the buck that they're promised, whether they're subsidizing movie developments or stadium boondoggles or anything else. And so I think that subsidies are sort of an addiction that Hollywood has that have kind of distorted its production accounting. It would probably be a good thing to try and reckon with that aspect of sort of the cost of movie making. I would love it if more movies were shot in the United States, especially because it would be nice to just see more American cities and towns in the US. But using the sort of magic tariff hammer to, you know, slam down this particular nail does not make any sense at all.
You know, it's funny because I have long complicated feelings about the whole tax subsidy thing in right. The sense that, like, I agree with you that if you're selling this as we're actually going to make more money, we're going to bring in more tax revenue. Like, come on, don't let's not be silly. Yeah. If you want to use it as a way of saying, hey, we're going to bring jobs here and there will be jobs. And that works for a while. It worked for a while in Georgia. Right. There was a huge filmmaking hub there. Lots of people were making jobs, you know, not just the actors who come in and not just, you know, you've got crews.
People who cater, who do makeup, who, you know, provide animals for shoots. There are definitely sort of short-term economic gains to getting, you know, an industry to functionally relocate part of its operations to your city. But if those, you know, if those credits sort of go on forever, they become much less of a good deal.
Well, and also we're seeing exactly what happens when you try to do them. If you have these credits in Georgia and somebody comes along and offers a better one, the companies are just going to move. There's no reason. There's no reason to shoot in Georgia if you're just going to be shooting in a warehouse full of green screens.
Yep. Mm-hmm, exactly. And so, again, just sort of like setting aside that sort of distortion of Hollywood economics and sort of what movies look like, little girls are going to have two dolls and we're going to have no movies and we're going to have five pencils. And this is Trumponomics, right? It's just like, let's make everything more expensive and confusing and stupid.
Well, and the confusing is the important part here because, you know, there are, these are things that take years, sometimes decades to put together. When you make a $200 million movie, it's not a thing that you just do.
Right. And how are you supposed to do that when it's like, is the budget actually $400 million now? Is it that theaters are going to have to charge twice as much for the tickets, right? It totally upends your economic assumptions in making something. And I think this is something that we see up and down in the economy. Like, you know, in my day job, I edit letters from people who come to the, who write to the Washington Post. And we, you know, we have a letter out today that's from a small business owner basically just saying like, tell me what to do. Tell me what the sort of economic fundamentals for my business are. And so he runs like, he runs a small business making LED signs, right? And it's impossible for him. And I have no idea how you do any of these assumptions on a larger scale. This is not just a problem for studios who make the movies. Like, if I'm in the, you know, the theatrical business and I'm trying to figure out like, what does this mean for me? Are the tariffs going to be collected on tickets? Am I going to get leaned on even more by Disney to do block booking for Marvel movies that squeezes out other things that might sort of be surprising hits? Like, this is just, there is a real cruelty to throwing people's lives this much up in the air. And I mean, it's just, it's economic policy for the lulz, right? It's not even economic policy. It's just, you know, sort of random garbage that's getting floated out there that has a real impact in the world. And yeah, I don't know how you move forward on any of this. It seems exhausting.
That is, the long and the short of it is that it is just like, it's just another thing, right? It's just like, here's another crazy thing because we're being governed by tweet. I want to nail down one thing here that I think is, again, kind of interesting and also totally wrongheaded, which is the suggestion that this is a national security issue. Because there's two different ways to interpret national security threat here. One is that it's a national security threat that we don't have a proper film production business in America, in Hollywood, in Georgia, wherever else, which is, I guess, possible. You know, maybe you need people out there for the good of the national security making movies at home. And if you lose that skill set, it's bad.
How else will we be ready to have our like wartime propaganda when we need to make newsreels and like movies about our brave boys at the front if we don't have the talent here at home?
Exactly. Who's going to do Why We Fight if everything is shot in France and Britain? The secondary idea here is it's a national security threat because the American film industry is giving up its soft power advantage that his, and this is a thing we've talked about a lot on this show.
Yes.
This is a thing that we have discussed a lot on the show, and I'm sympathetic to it to a certain extent, at least insofar as like, yes, I think it's bad for American studios to chase Chinese pennies.
Yes.
But I also don't consider that to be a, you know, a quote unquote national security threat. That's insane.
Yeah. I mean, I think you and I, probably more so than Peter, are in favor of Hollywood sort of decoupling from the Chinese market, not in the sense of decoupling from Chinese civilians, but decoupling from the sort of censorship apparatus that determines what can be let into China. And as we talked about this on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I sort of made the point that, you know, that pursuit of market access in China did kind of pull Hollywood out of geopolitical debates in certain ways, right? It meant that Hollywood movies were obscuring Taiwan as an independent country, or that, you know, Hong Kong was autonomous in some way. You know, it also means that, you know, you could never have movies where the US was in military conflict with China, or even, you know, sort of intelligence conflict. And so Hollywood was sort of steered away from just telling certain kinds of stories about our emerging geopolitical reality. Whether that's a national security threat, I mean, I think that is, national security threat is something that I think we should all have an interest in defining that quite narrowly, right? If only because of the expansion of government power that it kind of warrants in all sorts of spheres. But I do think that we should want American soft power to be so strong that there are not ideas that are excluded from movie making, that there are not actors excluded from movie making, like Richard Gere, right? I mean, who's essentially had his career upended because he thinks that, you know, Tibet should be free and autonomous. And so I do think he represents sort of a certain weakening of American soft power if our movies can't express a whole range of sentiments. I don't think it's a national security emergency. And even if it were, tariffs? I'm sorry. It's so dumb.
Yeah, I mean, I think the long and the short of it is that this is just one more. Trump has one thing he can do right now.
Yeah.
Because they're not passing any legislation. God forbid. God forbid anybody try to, like, pass a law. That's ridiculous. What sort of world do you live in?
Also, he just enjoys executive orders and governance by tweet, right? I mean, you know, there's a sort of, there's a bizarre frictionlessness to it where you can say, like, I will revoke Harvard's tax exemption. Hollywood will be tariffed somehow. I don't know. We're all like, we're going to parade like 6 million pink elephants down the street of Washington, D.C. in honor of my birthday. And it doesn't even have to come to pass, but the chaos is the governance result, right? And I have never met Donald Trump. I have no particular insight into his personality, but he seems to enjoy that, right? I mean, he's not someone who's like in politics because he has serious interest in governance or passing legislation. Yeah. He's in governance because like it's really fun to make people jump when you say how high.
He wants to be the deal maker. He wants to be the person that people come to and be like, show us the art of the deal, Donald. Make us, help us figure this out. How do we get this done? And he has the answer, because, and only he has the answer, because whatever answer is in his brain.
Yes.
It's in his head. It's in his dumb head. Anyway, all right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that Trump wants to put a quote unquote 100% tariff on the movie industry? Alyssa.
Obviously it's a controversy.
It's an insane controversy. It's just idiotic from start to finish. There's nothing about this that makes any sense. There's somebody needs to sit John Voight down and be like, hey, you got to get him back off this. Tell Mel Gibson doesn't shoot movies in America. Tell Mel Gibson to go in there and be like, hey, we kind of need to do this another way. This isn't going to work.
Yeah. So.
Vince Vaughn. Vince Vaughn shoots all his movies on like Island Nations now. Have him do it. I don't know.
Well, I mean, right. Because why wouldn't you?
All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday, where we're going to be discussing an effort to improve the classic rom-com Notting Hill via AI actors. Spoiler, it was horrifying and made me want to die. Speaking of suicidal ideation, on to the main event, Thunderbolts with an asterisk in the title. Why is the asterisk there? Well, we'll get to that at the end. Spoilers. There will be spoilers, though, so if you're worried about knowing what happens in Thunderbolts, please turn the podcast off now. Okay, you've had enough time. All right, so Thunderbolts is kind of like B-Team Avengers. You've got Yelena, played by Florence Pugh, who teams up with short-time Captain America, John Walker, who's played by Wyatt Russell. There's super criminal Ghost, played by Hannah John Kamen, and a mysterious guy named Bob, played by Lewis Pullman. And they are all brought together by CIA head Valentina Allegra de Fontaine, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus. And she wants to have them all killed because they're loose ends. They end up joining forces with the Red Guardian, Alexei Shostakov. I think I'm getting that right. Played by David Harbour, and Bucky Barnes, the Winter Soldier, played by Sebastian Stan. They need to take down the Superman tier enemy Sentry, who evolves into the Void, a villain whose superpower is making people feel very sad. It's literally his power. No, really. I mean, seriously, that's his power. He's like, I'm gonna make you feel sad. Kind of accidentally. It's like, he's like manic depressive Superman. It's kind of cool in that way. He sends his enemies to a mental prison of sorts, the Void, where they relive their worst memories over and over again, which causes them to despair and give up hope. He's like the human embodiment of that really sad swamp in The Neverending Story, right? Like where everybody in his little prison is Atreyu remembering Artax's death over and over again. That reference is really going to hit for that 30 to 45 year old age range out there. If you're not in our cohort, I apologize. Anyway, I got to be honest. I like this movie. This is a solid collection of heroes to pull this trick with, because they're all kind of oddballs and failures in their own way. Right. People joke that this is like Marvel Suicide Squad. That's not wrong. Exactly. Yelena is a longtime assassin who yearns to be the hero her sister, the Black Widow, was. John Walker blew it as Captain America, and his wife has left him, and she took their kid, and he's in a shame spiral. Bucky Barnes has spent most of his life as an assassin for Hydra. So there's plenty of shame to go around, But Thunderbolts is not a sad sack movie, very importantly. Occasionally poignant, yes, but it's also very funny, right? There's just good camaraderie and chemistry, particularly between Pugh, Pullman, Harbour, and Russell. We talked about fun hangout movies last week with The Accountant 2. And I think this is another one, honestly. It's a band of misfits that fits pretty well together. All the MCU stuff is there, and it's fans of the franchise, people who've been following it closely, will have lots to dig into, I'm sure. But it's still all kind of window dressing and relatively de-emphasized. Even the stuff with Dreyfuss's character, who is supposed to be kind of like Nick Fury, I guess. She's evil. She's like amoral, evil Nick Fury. It's self-contained enough that you really don't have to have seen anything else to understand her role here. There's a lot of very helpful exposition dumps early in the movie that kind of tell you what her deal is. Honestly, the nicest thing about Thunderbolts is that it feels like a real self-contained movie. It's got a coherent visual schema. Shadows replay and repeat, emphasizing the film's heart of darkness. And genuine emotional growth occurs for all the characters, who all have real arcs, more or less. It's funny, it's kind of sweet, there's some decent action. This is what the MCU was doing effortlessly at its peak, right? It was just a series of self-contained films with a little bit of resonance across the cinematic universe to keep people coming back entry to entry, but everything kind of worked on its own when it worked. Hooray for competence. It's been a while since we've had just a good, competent movie of this sort. And about that asterisk, at the end of the movie, it's revealed that this team is the new Avengers, leading to a post-credit scene, which confirms, for the record, that David Brooks is part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But it also suggests there's some sort of trademark infringement fight with Sam Wilson, a.k.a. the new Captain America. Alyssa, are you excited for Thunderbolts 2, copyright pending?
I mean, yeah, I guess so. I think I probably liked this a little less than either of you. I think part of what's tricky about it for me is that, you know, thinking back to what made the original Avengers team up sort of so exciting is that you'd had real strong individual introductions to all of these characters. And then it was, you know, it was fun to see them all come together. And we just have very varying levels of sort of knowledge about or investment in the characters on this ostensible new team, right? Obviously, like Bucky Barnes, totally, you know, solid, happy to see him on screen. We've had, you know, more time with John Walker. You know, Ghost has
if you've watched Captain or the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which was a Disney Plus show, and you know, that,
you know, Ghost has never really, like, she's just sort of there, right? I don't even remember what all she's shown up in.
Ant-Man 2, I think.
Okay. But I have no investment in that character at all. Just, like, absolutely none. And they don't give her anything in this movie that would make you more invested in her, right?
Agreed.
Like, she's just totally flat. You know, I think that Florence Pugh and David Harbour are great in this. Like, Florence Pugh is awesome. I will watch her in absolutely anything. She is really magnetic and fun on screen. She feels different than other characters that we've seen, right? I mean, I think she does in the sense that she feels a lot younger and more vulnerable, right? I mean, this is a movie about depression to a certain extent. And, you know, I mean, the sort of climactic scene between her and Alexei is just sort of pure emotional acting by both of them. And it's lovely. It's like her face is a wonderful special effect. I mean, there are a lot of little things about this that I did enjoy, right? Like Geraldine Viswanathan is really funny as Valentina's like sort of conflicted assistant. That's a character like I would enjoy seeing more of her around. I think it was always going to be incredibly complicated for them to sort of have a handover when you just can't spend as much time getting us invested in and excited about each of the individual characters in the same way.
One way that this does feel familiar to Suicide Squad is that, kind of like in that movie, you know, you're essentially getting introduced to everybody for the first time, with the exception of the Winter Soldier, who's been in a bunch of movies and has, you know, is like the longest running character here.
Yeah.
And then Florence Pugh's Yelena, who, like, I think the reason she works is because she feels more like the actual Black Widow from the comic book. She's like an actual, she's got like an actual Russian accent. And she is like she's like really kind of an actual assassin, you know, killing people all the time.
And that opening sequence of her just in sort of like a blasé, kind of depressed form, being like, okay, fine, I'll kill all of you. I don't want to blow this up. It would have been more convenient if I just like had your stupid face to put in the facial scanner. It's like, it's genuine. It's funny, right? And I think that this is a movie where the humor works a lot better than some of the recent entries.
Yeah.
Having John Walker bragging about being like back-to-back-to-back-to-back like high school football champion. It's just like they do a nice job of taking a character who could be just radically unsympathetic and making you feel kind of sorry for him.
Well, I want to talk about this a little bit because we watched all of Falcon and the Winter Soldier, right? Because that show, the whole point of that show was to be like, this guy doesn't deserve to be Captain America. We need Sam Wilson to be Captain America. And I remember watching that show and just being like, you know, I feel bad for him. I feel bad for him because he's in over his head. The character himself has relatable problems in the sense of like, one day he accidentally got important at work and it ruined his life.
Yeah.
And like that's like, and it, you know, in this movie, he's depressed because he gets fired and he's like on his phone and his wife's like, why aren't you watching the kid? And he's like, the kid's right here. He's in the crib. What do you want from me? And like, again, this is not, it is not intended, I think, to be terribly sympathetic, but it's certainly relatable. That's a relatable thing.
And I actually, like, I found that moment, like, quite sympathetic, actually. I mean, I don't think it's quite a portrait of, like, male postpartum depression, which is a real thing. And it's, like, sort of not talked about at all. But, like, the sight of a guy who is, like, clearly not totally bonded with his kid, but at the same time is, like, talking about being, like, he's, like, I'm a husband and a father, right? It's, like, that identity is still very important to him, even though like, and he's disguising that he blew it up. I mean, I think he is an interesting character just in that it's like being a hero is really hard. It's, you know, it's a real burden to thrust on someone. And asking someone in particular, like, it's one thing to be like, I'm going to be a fun dirtbag like Tony Stark. It's another thing to be like, I'm going to be like the moral upstanding embodiment of America's best conception of itself. Like, it's actually a lot. It's a lot, you know? Yeah.
And it helps that Wyatt Russell is, I think, genuinely charismatic in a way that is sometimes missing from these characters and these performances. He is, I mean, look, he's Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn's kid.
Yeah.
So he's got a leg up in terms of
the facial structure. Yeah.
He's got the genes for it. Put it that way. I've yet to see him in something and not come away thinking he's the most interesting person on the screen, or at least one. This is a good collection between Pugh, Harbour, and Wyatt Russell. It's a good collection, but also Lewis Pullman, another Nepo kid. We got Bill Pullman's son out there. Does not look anything like his father at all. No, he looks exactly like him. But again, he does. I think he's pretty compelling as Bob, as the character known as Bob.
I had forgotten that he was also the character known as Bob in Top Gun Maverick.
So many Bobs.
But yeah, no, as someone who's just like, he is very good at capturing that sort of jittery, kind of dislocated affect. And again, I mean, he is a character who has heroism thrust upon him when he is clearly not ready to be a vessel for that. And again, I think the movie does a nice job of, and I mean, it helps, of course, that like he doesn't actually kill anybody, right? I mean, they give him a superpower where like people kind of turn into shadows and then they come back and like it's fine. So he doesn't actually hurt anybody, but you know, you can have a lot of sort of sympathy and pity for him. Can we talk for a second about like the whole Bucky Barnes has run for Congress? I don't understand this development at all.
There are two things in this movie that frankly make no sense to me. So this was briefly mentioned in Captain America: Brave New World. Remember,
right.
He was like, he was either running for Congress.
He had to go to a fundraiser.
Congressman-elect.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't remember.
He was like going to a fundraiser.
So that has been kind of introduced.
Yeah.
Maybe it came up at the end of Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I don't remember. But like, he's a congressman now. He's going to impeachment. Wait, I also had a question about, can you impeach the CIA director? I think you can.
I believe you can impeach cabinet, like Senate confirmed.
That's what I thought.
I believe that.
A foreign friend of mine asked, like, can you actually do that? I was like, I'm pretty sure if you're confirmed by the Senate, you can be impeached by the Senate. But
I would want to look that up. I am also not 100% sure. But like, why? And he's not even on the committee for the impeachment.
No, he's just showing up.
Yeah. He also appears to have no staff. Like, I mean, even a member of Congress has a communications director. Like, you know, folks, like my husband's cousin is Rebecca Katz, who is like, you know, campaign strategist based out of Brooklyn. And I was sort of joking, it'd be really funny to call her up and be like, what is the candidate memo for Bucky Barnes? Like, weaknesses, he's 100 years old, but pro, like, he's much more together than like Dianne Feinstein. Cons, he's like, he's murdered a lot of people, like just a lot of people, and also was brainwashed, but like, he looks like Sebastian Stan. He's handsome. Maybe he's like a New Deal Democrat, right? Like, but why is it a good use of Bucky Barnes' time to be in Congress?
There's a version of this movie where they spend more time with him grappling with the uselessness of being one of several hundred congressmen and being a singular superhero, right? Who can actually do things. And they do kind of touch on this a little bit. I think it's clear that he's just kind of tired of... It's actually not clear. But by the end of the movie, I get the sense that he's basically done being a congressman and is just going to be a hero all the time now.
I guess so. But it's also just like... I would totally have watched like a half hour comedic thing about like Bucky Barnes running for Congress, right? Because it's like, is it that he's just like, he's 100 years old, his best friend like time traveled into the past to marry the girl of his dreams and just like ditched him? Like, he spent some time hanging out in Wakanda. It's like, why not run for Congress? Like, you know.
Superhero like, Veep, MCU Veep.
Right. It's just like, it's just very strange. It's just very odd. I mean, admittedly, it would be really funny if you could send like a superhero person down to track down all the people who are like avoiding your subpoenas for congressional hearings, which is functionally what he does in this movie. Although then he doesn't actually deliver them to Congress. So
the second thing I wasn't 100% sure about is, again, as I kind of alluded to at the top, there's this post-credit scene where apparently Sam Wilson is suing them about using the name The Avengers, which... it comes out of nowhere. That's not anywhere in Captain America: Brave New World. Like, he's not.
Also, he doesn't have a squad. Like,
he does. Yeah, there's no Captain America Avengers team right now. It's very unclear what's happening. It feels like we missed something.
Yeah, I think they just wanted to have Alexei refer to him as like a litigious idiot or something, or like a litigious moron. But it's like, what? I don't know.
I will say there's one thing that happened. I'm not going to fully spoil it, but there's a thing that happened in the post-credits sequence for the Thunderbolts movie. That's a big reveal for an upcoming Marvel movie. That's all I'll say about it. And one person in my theater like clapped, and somehow that was sadder than having zero people clap. it was one person was like, yeah. Like kind of quietly put his hands away. Again, I think this is a very solid, entertaining superhero movie, but it does feel like this franchise has kind of run out of juice. Like it is really on fumes here.
Yeah. It was funny. I was sitting in a theater with like a couple of college students, one of whom had never seen a Marvel movie before.
Sure.
And walking out, her friend her was like, I'm going to show them to you. We're going to do a marathon. And it's like, oh, honey, that's going to take days and days and days. Like, I was rooting for this other girl to just like say no and go on with living her life.
There's no escaping.
She seemed like she was being talked into it. So
what else are you going to do with your life? You know,
I don't know, like have kids, like be out in the world, go to museums, make art, like have a sourdough starter, go to class.
Ugh, gross. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Thunderbolts? Alyssa.
Thumbs up. It's fine.
Peter's review was pretty positive, so I'm going to impute a thumbs up to him. Just take my word for it. I will also give it a thumbs up. It's a fun movie. If you like these movies, fun movie. It's competent. And that is not... People treat competence like a slur. It is not. That's a positive thing.
Totally.
All right, that is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Rupert Manderstam, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter at SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.